My name is Ruth Hanusa. This is the first session in my third week. Genesis 1 that interests me, and that's talking about God creating the sea monster. And I recently traced where that sea monster pops up in the Old Testament. Let's begin. Do y'all have Bibles? I'll go with the RSV, assuming most of you are working with that, unless you are knitting or something. I call it Madame Defarging, which is fine. Don't stop just because I can't do it. I'm jealous. Genesis 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The word behind create here is a Hebrew word called bara. That word also occurs frequently in Isaiah, especially chapters 40 to 55, which scholars believe is somewhat contemporaneous to the guy who wrote this particular chapter. Bara is not only means on the surface to create, but it has behind it the idea of redemption. God's creation work is also his redemption work. We Westerners like to split it neatly into two separate articles. That's not so clear here. When God is creating, he is also redeeming. I better tell you first a little bit about this author. The scholars call him the priestly writer. And they believe that he wrote at the time, somewhere around when the Israelites were in Babylonian captivity. What had happened is that the prophets had warned them that if they didn't shape up, they would be shipped off to exile, which indeed happened. And just before the exile, however, the temple was destroyed. They were taken off the land. The Davidic succession of kings was in jeopardy. And it was a real crisis of faith for the people of Israel at this time. In their world in Babylon, there were many religious tales, which were known as myths, still are known as myths. And they differed considerably from the faith of the Hebrews. Now, let me say a bit about myth first. When we use it, we normally say, is it myth or truth? Is it myth or fact? And when we mean myth is an untruth. That's what we mean. That's not how I'm going to use it today. That's not what is meant in terms of this kind of literature. A myth technically is a story of the gods. But bigger than that, or more than that, it also it conveys great truths. It may not be factual, but it's truthful. For instance, there are myths about Holden Village. There is a myth about this place. You may know some of, is this your first day here or second day here? You may not know all of them. One is, I think, a myth is that Holden Village is on the cutting edge in terms of justice movements in the church. Now, you may say that is or not is not the case, but that is what is, for those who identify with Holden, that is a truth that they believe about themselves in this place. Okay? It may or may not be true, but that's what we believe about this place. Let me tell you another thing about truth and fact. Assume you have a friend who is in the hospital and you don't know anything about the medical condition but that your friend is dying. And you can go in and talk to your friend about life and death and what each means to her. Or you can know that there's a person in the hospital who has cancer and you know all the medical terms and the conditions and the prognosis and the the healing that they're going to go through. And you can go in and talk to this person about their treatments and whether they're feeling sick today and whether they're losing their hair and on and on and on, and never talk to them about life and death. In the first case, you talk about the truth, life and death, and what that means to them. Second place, just talking about the facts of your condition does not mean that you are even touching the truth. Truth and fact are not necessarily related, and I don't want to maybe pit them against each other. I kind of see truth as a huge gem, many-faceted gem, and I can be standing on this here in front of one particular facet, and you're over here looking at another one. And so we might see the gem in different silhouette, in different proportions, but we're all looking at the truth. Okay? I'll proceed now. We can talk about that later if you don't like it. Verse 2. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. This author does not try to account for how this chaos, as it's sometimes called, appears. Just that the earth had no form, it was void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Doesn't tell us how the deep even got there. The Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. Some commentators think that this isn't so much the Spirit of God brooding, but it's just a mighty wind that's whipping across the waters, and this is still a description of the chaos. You can go either way, whichever one you like. Either it's still wild or the Spirit is beginning to move. Verse 3, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening and there was morning one day. That's what God does on the first day. I'll put this up. You'll notice that the order is evening and there was morning. That reflects the biblical, the Hebrews, reckoning of days as always starting the evening before. If you have Jewish friends, you know that the Sabbath always begins at Friday sundown. It doesn't begin Saturday morning. And it ends sundown Saturday. That's the ordering of their days. It always begins the night before. You notice that God saw that the light was good. The priestly writing has seven goods in this account. And by the end, I hope you can see why. Verse 6, and God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and separated the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and there was evening and there was morning a second day. This firmament is kind of like a big burnished dome that's in the heavens. And the idea was is that above this dome were all the waters of the heavens. And there were windows in this firmament. And when God decides it's going to rain, he just opens a few of these windows, depending on where he wants it to rain. If he wants it all rain in the north, he just opens the northern windows. If he wants the south, just the southern windows. And when God's tired of it raining, he shuts the windows up, and that holds back the waters that are above the firmament. When God really wants it to rain, when he wants it to flood, he opens up all the windows, and they flood the earth. When he's tired of that, he closes the windows and shuts them up. We don't have that notion anymore, but that's the picture here that they worked with. And so then there were also other waters that were underneath the earth, the waters of the sea. A little glimpse of what is behind this is one of the Babylonian myths came into being to explain how Marduk, a god, became the Babylonian city god. And the story goes is that he was kind of a lesser god, and he rose to prominence by having this battle with this mighty sea monster called Tiamat, other names too, sometimes Rahab. And in this battle, when he finally defeats her, he takes his sword and he just slices her in half like a big clamshell. And the top half of her he puts up in the heavens, the waters up here, and the bottom half is the underground sea. What the priestly writer is saying, he's using that story that was around him and saying, God did that. It wasn't Marduk, the god whom all your captors worship. Somebody much bigger than that who did that. Not only did he split her, he even created her. That's second day. Got to get that up. So he separates above and below waters. Can you read this? Kind of crazy, right?
Is it H2O2?
Oh, no, waters. It's H2O, plural. Okay, verse 9. And so God says, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. Before this, the dry land and the waters were all mixed up, kind of a nice swamp stuff. So God kind of collects them, or at least he calls it to be. That's another thing, this whole creation by the word. Word had a great deal of power for the Hebrew peoples, which we sometimes give nod to, but not nearly to the extent they did. When God spoke, things happened. The prophets always begin, "The word of the Lord came to me," and they are just gripped by it. They can't get out of it. The word has such power. There are two tenses in Hebrew, perfect and imperfect. The imperfect has to do with things that are going to be in the future. I'm going to do this. After this class, I'm going to go have a candy bar. That's imperfect. God willing, I get there before they close at 11. Perfect tense is stuff that has already been accomplished. When the prophets write sometimes of future events, they use perfect. Because God says he's going to do it, you might as well figure it's already done. The word has such power. John picks up on the word is Christ for John. And of course, we have word and sacrament, and sometimes we don't trust that word. You hear people say, well, it's only words. Doesn't matter much, just words and not action. But for the Hebrews, word had a great deal of power. Word motivated them. Okay, and God said, let the waters... Okay, we got that. The swamp is separating, and it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Another good there. Second day doesn't have good, I believe. Is that correct? Yes. First day is good. Third day is good. It's not said about the second. Before I forget, it's not clear why second day doesn't have it, but sixth day gets two of them. So if you've got a limit in your mind of only seven, you got to distribute them somehow. That kind of seems to be the case here. That it, you know, he's got seven, and so he decides how he's going to use them. I don't really have a good reason why second day isn't called good. Okay, third. Are we on third day? Yeah. The dry land comes. And of course, dry land has plants, right? That's an obvious corollary. 11, verse 11. And God said, let the earth put forth vegetation. Kind of a birthing idea. Plants yielding seed and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed. Now, no biologist today would divide all of the plants in the world by these two classifications. The plants yielding seed, like grain and stuff. And then the fruit trees that have fruit, the seed inside the fruit. But anyway, that's his classification, being in a pre-scientific age. Each according to its kind upon the earth. And it was so. 12, the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, a third day. And God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. And let them be lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made the two greater lights, great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heavens to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, a fourth day. Another one of the beliefs of the Mesopotamian peoples in which the Israelites were dispersed was that the sun and the moon and the stars were all gods, and they exerted control on human beings fatalistically, so that people were moved, and their actions were governed. Their life and their death were governed by what the stars were doing, or if the moon was eclipsing, or whatever. This all had a great deal of influence upon people. The priestly writer says, those aren't gods, they're clocks and they're calendars. They set the seasons and the days and the times of your festivals. You don't need to worship them. You don't need to be afraid of them. The God who created you, as he will soon tell us, is the one who created those clocks and those calendars for you. You needn't fear them or worship them. Let's see. We're getting the sun, stars, moon, etc. Now, you might notice that this author is not bothered by the discrepancy that while light is created on this day, the only way that we know of light is by sun, stars, and moon. It doesn't bother him that there's that kind of major discrepancy. That's okay. Doesn't have to bother us either. Verse 20. And God said, let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the firmament of the heavens. So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Another good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening, and there was morning, a fifth day. Okay, so we get birdies and fishies. Fishes. Sea animals and air animals. Now you notice that God creates the sea monster. In the Babylonian myth, Marduk had to battle the sea monster, and it wasn't all that clear whether he was going to win or not. Here, God Almighty created the sea monster. It's also interesting that there is a sea monster. I mean, of all of the things in this story, we can pretty much relate to one way or another. We see evidence of it. Aren't too many of us that believe in sea monsters. Somebody asked at the end of the staff session, is this leftover, the Loch Ness Monster somehow near kin of this creature? And beats me, I don't know. But that's the one thing that I find real, I guess, mythical and strange in this story, that God created the sea monsters. Verse 24, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures, again, a birthing image, according to their kinds, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. This description of all life on earth would seem strange to a 20th century biologist too, to divide the categories are cattle, wild beasts, and creeping things. That was his world, and that is how he described it. Verse 25, and God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the cattle according to their kinds, and everything that creeps upon the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. First, kind of the command is given, let the earth bring forth, and then it says that God made them. So both images are used. That's part of the sixth day. Land animals. God did a lot of work on the sixth day. Had a lot of catching up to do before the Sabbath. Then God said, let us make man in our image. What is behind the man is a Hebrew word that is Adam. It's not really the Mr. Adam of Genesis 2. Adam is the generic word for human being. The word for male and female, or man and woman, are separate, ish and isha. This is Adam. So it's, even though it, in our Bibles it looks as though it's a male person, it's not. Some have wondered if maybe it was an androgynous person who was later split into male and female. I don't know. Hard to tell. Who cares, huh? To make in our image after our likeness. Now, they've been wondering for years and generations what this let us means. Is that an early indication of the Trinity? You know, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit get together at creation and decide to do this. Most scholars feel that that would be anachronistic to put that interpretation on. The idea of the Trinity, or the word Trinity is not in the scriptures. There are references to Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. But that technical word Trinity is not in the scriptures. That's a later development in Christian thought. That doesn't mean it's not true. It's just that means that as the Spirit has worked through the centuries, in the lives of the people, in the lives of the church, different wordings and different categories come up that maybe the scriptures didn't have. Still can be true. Not everything, though, but I'm saying about this that it is. The notion of the Trinity was not developed at this point, so it probably would not be accurate to say that that's what is behind this. Sometimes they say that it's a plurality of majesty, that God is so great and so majestic that it's, you know, like the royal we, you know, that that's kind of what's behind this, perhaps. Another thing that is asserted sometimes, the word Elohim, which is translated God, is a plural form. The I-M ending is always a plural ending. Again, that, you know, they aren't real sure that that's it. The guy I worked off of this time wrote this book, Genesis. His name is Bruce Botter. What he says is it's simply as simple as what you might do, well, let's go to the store now. You know, kind of talking to yourself. That seems too simple, doesn't it? I mean, everybody's written pages and pages on this thing. I don't know. I really don't know what's behind that. The more theories that are trotted out about something may mean that there are more theories, the less certain they are. So anyway, it's not very clear what's behind that. And then being made in the image of God after our likeness. That too has puzzled people. Do we look like God? Does God look like us? Maybe that's more the thing. And for some people that can be unnerving. You know, I want God to stay up there in the heavens and be almighty. If he looks like me, well, goodness sakes, we are in trouble. Dorothy Sayers, who wrote my favorite mysteries, the Lord Peter Wimsey series, says that all we know at this point in the scriptures is that God created. And so the image that we are made of, the image in which we are made is what to create. We are made to be creators. And I think we are called to be co-creators because the command is given to have dominion and to rule over the earth. So there's some validity to that. Vodder says, he compares this with Psalm 8. I'll read you sections. When I behold your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you set in place, what is man that you should be mindful of him, or the son of man that you should care for him? You have made him a little less than the angels and crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him rule over the works of your hands, putting all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, beasts of the field, birds of the air, fishes of the sea. That kind of dovetails what comes next when God says, let them have dominion. You see, man in our image and let them, the plural is, more than one person is implied there. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Dominion is to rule. It's not used real often in the Hebrew, but when it does, it most often has the sense of a kingly rule. And kings at that time had absolute power. Absolute power. But they were not to exploit in their having dominion. So we are called, human beings are called to have dominion over all of the creation. Yet God is has dominion over them too. So we are kind of sub-kings, regents, in a sense, in God's creation. Another myth that was running around, or part of a myth, in Babylon at this time, was that after all of the gods had been created, there was this fight with an evil god and a good god. The evil god was defeated, and out of the blood and guts that remained of this evil god, they made human beings, savages, to be the servants or the yoke people for the gods. Now, I imagine that if you lived in a world that said you were made out of the blood and guts of an evil god, and that you were created to be a slave, your self-image wouldn't be real terrific. I don't think. And so one of the things a priestly writer is saying here is that you are not made out of the blood and guts of an evil god. The God Almighty called you into being because he loves you. And he doesn't say that. This is my exegesis. But out of his goodness, he called you into being. And you are not to be slaves. You are to rule. You are to be kings over this creation. I think he's flying right in the teeth of, flying in the face of what was the prevailing notion at that time. Verse 27, so God created Adam in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. I think this is the second bless. There's only three blesses. The first blessing, I should have mentioned it then, sea animals and air animals. Plants were not quite considered living things for them. biologists could talk about them respiring and some of them move and so forth. But animals are blessed. The human beings are blessed. And God said to them, now this is different too. When the animals are created, God gives them the command. Where is it? Verse 24, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kind. Well, I can't find it. Anyway, it's a command.
22.
It was in 22? Yes, bless them, be fruitful and multiply. When he talks to the human beings, and God said to them, just a hint of dialogue. God's going to draw a little closer to these folks than he does to the animals. After all, these are going to be the people of covenant. God is going to choose to covenant with human beings. He doesn't with the rest of his creation. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every... This is where Holden gets its dietary laws. Behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed which is upon the face of the earth and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. There's no meat here. And to every... But on the Sabbath, you can have some. And to every... 30. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life. That was the definition of life. I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. Now, no lion I know is going to be able to subsist on grasses. And those kitty cats that run around, too, they're chewing up chipmunks all the time. The world view of this guy was that God's intention for the world was that there not be violence. That life not come out of death, which is how we know it. That's the paradox of the life that we experience. Life comes out of death. And he says, surely that was not God's intention. Nobody can go that far back to say something contrary to him, to bring up any evidence. But he does not feel that that's the intention. In Hosea 11, there's that picture of the lamb shall lie down with the wolf, or the lion shall lie down with the lamb, and they shall neither hurt nor harm in my holy mountain. This idyllic picture of these carnivorous animals just sitting idly by a little lamb, defenseless. We don't know how that can exist. For us, as we perceive our world, it's an impossibility. I don't think it hurts to hope that maybe, you know, that too can be redeemed. I don't think that this necessarily is an order to be a vegetarian. I was joking about where the dietary laws come from here. I really don't know. But, you know, that's his view, that God did not intend that nature go against nature or that human beings do that. And that's the theological statement he's making here, not so much a dietary law.
Did I put humans up here?
And God saw, 31, God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Tov me'od in the Hebrew, very good. On the sixth day when the humans arrived, and kind of as a statement over all of the earth, it was very good. It was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, a sixth day. What do you see any, what's going on here, the way I've written it up? See any particular kind of pattern or ordering? What?
Two parallel stories.
Yeah. Well, that might have been it. It could be two combined stories. They talk about that. Different commentators will say, well, he had two stories here and he mushed them together. I kind of like taking the text as it lies, you know, and playing with it there. That's my tendency. But he kind of creates the spaces first, or at least that's how it's set out. And then there are people. They're filled up, like if you were going to build a house and furnish it. First you build the house, and then you put the furniture in it, in the particular rooms. And he just lets it be there, even with this glaring inconsistency that light was created 3 days before we ever get the sun, moon, and stars. So, anyhow, this guy likes pairing. He does a lot of pairing. Evening and morning and heavens and the earth. And Four verses into chapter 2. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work which he had done, and he rested. The Hebrew word is Shabbat. If you have Jewish friends, they often will call the Sabbath Shabbat. They'll say good Shabbat to you rather than Sabbath. So God blessed the seventh day. Here's the third blessing. One's on the
land animals.
Or on the birds and fish, right? Is that right? Yeah. Sixth is on the land animals, including humans. And the seventh is the Sabbath day. That is blessed. Only three of them, and the Sabbath day gets one. So God blessed it and hallowed it, because on it God rested from all his work which he had done in creation. The priestly writer kind of sees God as a faithful Jew going about his work, getting it all done, even works overtime on the sixth day to make it to the Sabbath. Do you remember the Fiddler on the Roof? The women just before Sabbath are rushing around trying to get everything done because you couldn't work on the Sabbath. You know, you almost get that picture of God here. He's hurrying to finish so that he can rest on the Sabbath day. When, after the Babylonian exile, when the temple was gone, they'd lost their land, all of the people did not return to Israel. The Davidic kingship was in jeopardy. One of the two things that the Israelites clung to was their worship of the Sabbath. And not their worship of the Sabbath, their observance of the Sabbath. That set them apart as a people. The other thing, of course, was circumcision. That gave them their identity. And for the priestly writer, this is very important. In a sense, whole creation is kind of a, I don't know, some people see it as a hymn even, you know, that God, the way God's ordering is not just creating the stuff, but he also gives order to our lives, our work days, our work week too. Let's see, where shall we go? I'll give you just a little snippet of this Rahab business. I had read it before but never bothered to look the passages up myself. The main places are Isaiah, Psalms, Job has a lot of them, one in Amos, where various pictures are used, but sometimes the picture is when they are doing creation snippets, and there are other stories of creation in the scriptures, that they refer to God as killing Rahab, crushing the dragon. Rahab, dragon, serpent, Leviathan are all kind of common terms for this great sea monster. But they say quite specifically that God killed this monster, not Marduk, but you killed him. Another place in Amos where there's a judgment being called upon the people, the sanctuary is going to be leveled, and God's even going after the people. And if they try to hide him, he's going to find him. If they go to the sea, he's going to send Leviathan to bite them. So here's a picture of God ordering Leviathan around. There's a long, long section in Job where when God finally answers Job chapters 40 and 41, where God is, there's Behemoth and Leviathan. Behemoth was a huge land beast of some sort. Leviathan, of course, the sea monster. Some wag in one of my seminary courses called this surf and turf, this section here. As God is saying to Job, can you battle, can you do the battle that I did with Leviathan? And he talks about the armor being plated so closely that you couldn't even get a spear in between. Long, long chapter. I think it's in 41, if you want to read that. Then the monster appears again in the book of Revelation. There's a serpent or a dragon, as you know, in the story of Revelation. And it's said quite explicitly that this dragon is that ancient serpent, the devil or Satan. So John's picture there of who the archenemy is battling against the martyrs is the same guy or woman, I mean, depending on how you describe the monster, who battled at creation and who has been giving people trouble ever since. Same one, he says. Throughout history, there's been a line of that. Then, in chapter 4 of Revelation, John sees the throne of God. God's here in the throne. Before the throne, there is a sea, bright as crystal. chapter 21, I believe it is, the serpent has been overthrown. Dragon, devil, serpent, is Satan is undone. And once again, we get a vision of the heavenly city, and there's a new heaven and a new earth, but the sea is no more. Finally, in the end times, this monster is gone, no longer to plague the people. Completely wiped out. The sea is no more. Shorthand term for this ancient serpent who has finally been defeated by the blood of the Lamb. Well, that's a quick overview of that. Do you have questions or comments or rebuttal?
Did you want to talk about why people were created on that sixth day?
I forgot. You tell me.
One of the priestly writer is talking to a people who, as you said, are pretty well lost.
Mm-hmm.
In Babylon,
mm-hmm.
and captured, enslaved, and no place to go home to. And what the way you talked about before really could be put down. And perhaps what the priestly writer is doing in this case is to make them, and this is my picture, I don't remember whether it's yours, the beauty queens. You know, when you have the Miss America pageant, you go from however, wherever they start, what is it, fifth place or fourth place,
tenth.
And who's going to be the winner? Well, you don't really know until you've only got two left, and then they call the second runner up. And the very last one named is the winner. And the last thing created are the people. And it's you are the light of my eyes. Not the heavens, which many people worship, not the rain, which we pray for and think we exist for, but you people are my delight.
Good. I don't think the beauty queen thing was mine. I don't remember dreaming that one up. Yeah, that's good though.
You also brought the food chain when you go. You start with the plants and then the birds and the fish.
Go up the food chain.
The land animals.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Skipping over the sun, stars, and moon.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it doesn't deal with the fact that the plants appear before their sun to have photosynthesis. I don't think this is so much a story as of how the world was created as for whom.
By whom?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. When I work with this stuff, or even Genesis 2, the whole thing of evolution and whatever theories there are about the creation of the earth, they don't even, they're just all outside of that. I don't think that we have to be schizophrenic as Christians, that when we're in school, we got to learn all that stuff and spout it all out. We pop into church on Sunday morning, and then we memorize this order. I don't think that that's the point. He's making more a theological statement, and considering his audience, he's preaching the gospel. He's not worried about how this stuff all got here. That's not his concern. Which is not to say that it's not our concern. I mean, we are 20th century people, and we need to live in our world in the same way that they had to live in their world. And in their world, he speaks the word of gospel to them. And I think it's so important to always remember the audience. We always do that. When you're talking to somebody, you are very well aware of their history. And you tell some things to certain people that you don't tell others. And it's not just gossip. And you also phrase it differently. And it's not just that you say it differently to children than adults. You make distinctions between different children and different adults. We always remember our audience. And we need to remember that about the scriptures too, that they wrote for people. I think it's highly arrogant. Maybe that's not a very nice way of saying it. But when people think that Revelation was just for us, and that the whole blueprint of our future, you know, Middle East battle and Soviet Union and all that stuff, wasn't written first for us. Jesus was coming, and we weren't going to be here in their plan. It was written for the people who were living and dying and suffering then, first for them. And we need to get into as much as we can to understand their world and their pain and their suffering and see how the gospel is spoken to them, and then make connections to ours. There's so much richness here, we can't see it just all as flat. You know, we just plaster ourselves against it anywhere. There's a lot of valleys and hills, and we stick better to some stuff than others, because it speaks to us, speaks to our time.
If you study all the other creation stories written at the same time, they're all very cruel, bloody, horrible, mm-hmm. ugly stories. This is the only one that came out of love and creation mm-hmm. and loveliness. Mm-hmm. The only sweet story of creation.
Sweet. I get a real warm feeling with this, and story of evolution, story theory, leaves me cold. There's no warmth in it. There's no art. There's no love. But this is a loving story from a loving God.
Who sows?
Huh?
Who sows?
Who sows, yes.
Something interesting I see in the story is, and at this point, my opinion is slightly different than his opinion, that the main point of creation is not the sixth day on the creation of human beings, but it's exactly the seventh day. Because I think our interpretation tends to be a little bit too anthropocentric and think, well, we are the main thing of creation. And I think it's a Sabbath per se, because if you see the situation of the people in exile, what would be more important than having one day for them to be together and celebrating their religion and their cultural identification?
Yeah, that's true, because those people were slaves, or at least saw themselves. They were certainly exiles and captives. So a day of rest was important.
Mm-hmm.
But I think both are true. But you brought up a real good point that this story, while it does say something to our time, I think. The one in Genesis 2 that was written to a fat cat population when David's king, the Davidic kingdom, was at its high point. They had lots of money and they had lots of power, and they were going about just using it however they wished. And his message to them was, God Almighty got down in the mud and created you out of ooze. You know, that's where your roots are. You're just made out of dust. And you are blessed to be a blessing. And maybe that is has a little more potency for our time and our people, our place, we who are fat cats and have power to exploit. And the message to us is to bless and be a blessing. So it's important to keep the context in mind, ours and the audience.
Ruth, in the image of God, I've always had some comfort in the thought that God is a spirit, and as he created man, in his image, the spirit or the soul of man was also referenced in that creative line. We look like yeah. him, and he doesn't look like something. He's a spirit, and
yeah.
our soul,
yeah.
he is also creative.
Yeah. Yeah, you are. I'll let anybody believe whatever they want about that, because I don't know. You know, the Hebrews did have strong injunctions against creating an image of God. You know.
Another thing on this, you know, firmament, where you said you didn't say it was good, if you use the analogy of a diamond cutter, where you started off and had the diamond and you cut it in half and it really wasn't anything else, and then when you started putting the facets on it, like the dry land and the birds, and then it started looking good, and then when it was done, I think you said it was very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
And beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm wondering too if maybe there's just a hint of, because the above and below waters were the sea monsters, that maybe there's just a hint of that there. Doesn't say that it's bad. It's just that he distributes his seven goods differently. Which maybe points up to then the goodness of the sixth day, which is the human stuff. Maybe emphasizes that.
When you refer to the sea monster, in this version it says that God created great whales.
Mm-hmm. It's, which version do you have there?
I think this is the Gideon Bible. It must be the King James.
Okay. What are some of the others do you have?
Sea monsters.
Sea monsters? What's that?
RSV.
Yeah, RSV. That's what I've been working with. Jerusalem has monsters?
I don't know. I have to. You have the Jerusalem.
I do, but I what verse is that?
21.
God created great sea serpents. That's what this has.
And what? And that's.
And I don't know what in the Hebrew, huh?
That's the fifth day. Verse 21.
Yes.
Okay. And but that's also saying that God created sea monsters.
Yeah.
That. When you were talking to me about Revelation and the sea monster there, that sea monster, that behemoth or whatever, is part of God's creation. That's not a god, but part of the creation.
Mm-hmm.
That puts that's a different category there too.
You implying something else by the whale?
Well, I'm just wondering about when you're talking about slaying the sea monster and so forth.
Yeah.
Comment on that.
What are you wondering about?
Laying a whale?
Are you talking about sea monster or more than one girl?
Well, the story of Marduk is that there was this mythological goddess called Tiamat, and she was a sea monster, and sometimes she is, they refer to the entire sea as but Tiamat. Tehom is the word for the deep, and that has some parallels. Here it says God created the great sea monsters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's devil, eventually.
Well, that's what Revelation says. At this point, that wasn't the understanding.
I can't remember where it is in the Bible where God plays in the water, frolics with the sea monsters.
I wonder if that's the Job pattern. I think we need to look at some of those. I'm just, there's about a dozen here, and I'm just.
But that to me is so the greatness of God, playing.
Why don't some of you turn to Job 41?
Before we do that, this because it says monster doesn't mean it's evil. Doesn't that word mean that it's large? Today we say monster, it must be evil.
Yeah.
But if we looked it up in a dictionary, we don't have one here, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's an evil thing.
Yeah.
Look at all the beautiful big things in the ocean, like whales and porpoises and sharks and so on. They're beautiful, really. They're just living their own lives.
Yeah.
In a way, that's a different thing.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean they're evil.
No. But the Hebrews, too, had a different. Their death at sea was horrible for them. Partly because it was. Well, you couldn't reclaim the body, and so you could not, you couldn't have a proper burial, go to the fathers in a sense. But it also was the place, in the ordering, as they understood their universe, their world, is that the place of the dead and the waters were, they didn't exactly know where one left off and the other didn't. And so the sea was a very fearful thing and scary thing. And the disciples, too, when Jesus is in the boat and he stills the storm. I mean, that's the word, I think in Mark, the word is he muzzled it. He muzzled the sea, which is the same word that is used when Jesus casts out the demons. He muzzles them. I don't remember what it is in Greek now. But that I think their worldview was such that the sea was personified and real scary. We don't have that much. I mean, Jacques Cousteau gets out there and does his camera stuff, and they go down, and we see them playing with sharks and all kinds of stuff. And so a lot of that fear is taken away, and we see the coral reefs and all this gorgeous stuff down there. They do microscopic things. So we see the beauty, but they didn't.
And also, you have to realize all the way through Columbus, they thought we were flat. I mean, that we're going to fall off.
Yeah.
It's only in our history that we knew it was random.
Yeah. And some of the maps at the time of Columbus, there were, those? They had
monsters
all on the edges there. You didn't dare go near. I haven't really done a history or even read anyone who's done a history of like a sea monster theme and how far that went. I don't know. I've asked some of you to go to Job, however. let's see. And 40:15 is the behemoth. God says, "Behold, behemoth, which I made as I made you. He eats grass like an ox," and so forth. Then in 41, can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? Can you go get him out of that stream up there, Donkey Lake? Or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his noose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Now, I don't know if God and Leviathan have this dialogue going. They speak soft words. I wonder what's behind that. I don't know. Will he make a covenant with you to take him for your servant forever? There's quite an intimate relationship that's being implied here. Let me skip down. Verse 8, lay hands on him. Think of the battle. You will not do it again. I think that's referencing to that, the primeval battle that is ascribed to God. You can read through some of that yourself if you want. I want to also look at Psalm 104, which is a creation psalm. That maybe is the best single one to look at since we're running out of time here. Where's Psalms? Here it is. Especially starting with verse 5, Psalm 104. You did set the earth on its foundation so that it should never be shaken. You did cover it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. I think that's kind of like this separating the dry land. At thy rebuke they fled, that is the waters. At the sound of thy thunder they took to flight. And when they took to flight, the mountains rose. The valleys sank down to the place which thou didst appoint for them. You did set a bound which they should not pass, so that they might not again cover the earth. You make springs gush forth in the valleys. They flow between the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild asses quench their thirst. By them the birds of the air have their habitation. They sing among the branches. From your lofty abode you waterest the mountains. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of thy work. You did cause the grass to grow for the cattle, and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth, and wine to gladden the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread to strengthen man's heart. The trees of the Lord are watered abundantly, the cedars of Lebanon which he planted. In them the birds build their nests. The stork has her home in the fir trees. The high mountains are for the wild goats. The rocks are a refuge for badgers. You have made the moon to mark the season. The sun knows it's time for setting. That's day 4 up here, clocks and calendars. You make darkness and it is night, and all the beasts of the forest creep forth. The young lions roar for their prey, seeking their food from God. I'm going to skip down here. 25 and 6. Yonder is the sea, great and wide, which teems with things innumerable, living things both small and great. There go the ships and Leviathan, which you did form to sport in it. This is a picture of God creating Leviathan. There are others. If you want, I maybe should put them on the board.
Yeah.
Do you have a Hebrew word for sea monster?
Do I have it?
Uh-huh.
I'll look it up for you. There, I think there's probably Biblia Hebraica in there. I didn't bring it along. We traveled in a Tercel, and there were limits to what books I could bring. I'll check it up though. Look it up, and tomorrow I'll tell you what's behind that. I'm not sure. Let me put some of these on the board if you want to look them up later. Meanwhile, you can keep talking if you want.
Juveniles, and I see them raising their hand like this a lot, and it's a sign of the devil. It's also a sign of something in worship. they worship. And it reminds me that, you know, I don't have that problem of worshiping the devil. I mean, God created the devil and has power over the devil. I think a lot of times those kids forget that. But sometimes I forget the fact that I'm also one of his creations, and I don't need to worship myself or the food I eat or the clothes I wear. That it already comes right down to that. I like the idea that the most important part of this whole creation story is the seventh day. And we take time out to thank God and to be a part of God's creation and not above it.
By the way, those mean I love you in sign language.
Yeah.
And they're up here because about 4 weeks ago we had impaired hearing people up here. We did a lot of signing for the whole week. It's interesting because this is me. You live long and prosperous. You need Star Trekkers. That's Balkanese.
Not where I come from.
The Sabbath, taking the Sabbath day was really a statement of faith for them. When life is hard and you aren't sure if you're going to have shalom bread every day, you want to work every day to get a little extra money, a little extra food or whatever. And taking the seventh day off, no matter how good a business deal you could make that day, is a statement of faith that you trust God with your survival, with your needs. So it really, really had that impact for them, that it was a faith statement to take a day off.
It'd be interesting too to find out just how that was put together in their captivity. You know, can you imagine the slaves, the captors, the captives saying to the captors, "Oh, by the way, tomorrow is our Sabbath."
Yeah. Yeah.
I won't be in tomorrow.
Well, the Jews still have trouble in some places getting the holidays off.
Why can't we as Christians do that on Sunday, even though the stores are open? Why don't we make a statement that that's our day of rest? And make it our statement in the world that we are not busy, 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 making, 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 adding, 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 loading, loading, loading. The one with the most toys wins attitude that America can have.
That's because the clergy, see, they all work, so they figure everybody else should too. Powerful, but not you.
Okay, so we'll make Monday the Sabbath.
Fine.
But that's interesting too, the way that you talked about that. We'll make money the Sabbath, and that's exactly what Jesus said. I mean, we make light of it, but for the writer of this, it wasn't that we made any day the Sabbath, it was that God made a day of rest. And yet, in the New Testament, we hear Jesus say that the Sabbath, that you were not made for the Sabbath, but that the Sabbath was made for you. So you have that tension. I don't think that one dissolves the other necessarily. I think it's a tension because you can't go on either side absolutely.
Now, if we have Sunday as a Sabbath and everybody gets a day of rest, does that mean we women don't have to cook?
In the Jewish religion, it's true.
They couldn't kindle a fire.
Yeah.
You had to cook 2 meals on Saturday.
That's right. That, no kidding, I have a Jewish recipe that takes 12 hours to bake. It's something with, I don't know what it's got in it, coolant or something it's called. And you could start it before sundown and then, you know, it could stay on a fire that was still glowing. I suppose you could probably, I don't know the laws, but you could probably add fuel, but you could not begin a fire. And so then for Saturday supper, you had what was begun.
Well, now, my great-grandmother had a neighbor who apparently, who I have to assume might have been Jewish, because those people would get their meal in the oven, and each Sabbath day for the neighbor, my great-grandmother would go and light their stove for them. But now, if they believe that,
are they not then leading her into a sin kind of thing?
Well, the Hebrews said about the Sabbath that it was to be observed by everybody in their community.
Mm-hmm.
And that took in the sojourn. The picture is of the kingdom where the Jewish people had the control over it. And so anybody who was in the community was exempt. And that included the farm animals, too. The oxen and everything was to take a rest. So
I think your grandmother was kind.
Oh, she was. Yeah. were they then not leading her into a sin type of thing? If they asked her to do something that should not be have been done that day? If they ask her to
I see what you mean. I see.
If I ask you to do something I know is a sin, do I not lead you into sin?
But
you are the sinner.
The Jewish people.
But having that person to do that.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, we're all sinners.
Yeah.
Maybe we ought to emphasize the word rest and be sure that we all have rest time for renewal.
Yeah.
And not get so hung up on the day, but on the concept of rest and renewal.
But that was not, because her tradition was different. Her faith was different. I don't know that was wrong for her.
Did they milk the cows on the Sabbath?
Yeah.
Did they have cows?
They had to.
They don't.
Yeah.
Well, my grandparents were not religious people at all, and they rested. They were dairy farmers, and that's all they did on Sunday. And the rest of they read books and they visited and they just rested that day. And for my grandfather, he said it's that renewal that got you through the rest of the 6 days. But it's something that was very important, that Saturday night bath, one bath a week. And my grandmother was pulling down her hair and braiding it back up again, and it was just for a day of rest on Sunday. Yeah.
But for the early church, though, the interesting thing was that the Jewish Christians had 2 days. They had Sabbath, and then they had the Lord's Day. And there was a big difference between Sabbath and the Lord's Day, mm-hmm. which is our Sunday. And they, in many cases, went worshiping in the temple and the synagogue on the Sabbath. And then the Lord's Day, the difference was that they heard the word of the Lord, but with another ingredient, and that was his presence in the bread and the wine. And that was not seen as a day of rest. That was a day of saying, this is the Lord's day. Let us be glad in it. And we got our holiday when Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the state. And if you were a Christian, you got Sunday off. That was the biggest church growth we ever had.
Well, for the Hebrews too, though, the Sabbath was not just a day when you not do anything. It was a time of hearing the word and, worship.
I have to dismiss you. It's 3 after. But if you want to stay, you can. But the tape's out, in other words.